This is the Neurosurgery Podcast.
Well, Dr. Byrne, here we sit in your office again, where we first met 4 or 5 years ago. For those listening, this is Dr. Richard Byrne, my boss, the chairman here at Rush University of Neurosurgery. He's been on the show a couple times before. I'll point you back to those episodes in the show notes. But today, we are here to talk about his career and his time at Rush as it's drawing to a close, sadly for those of us here, but happily for Dr. Byrne and his family. We'll get into all that, but Dr. Byrne, for those who haven't heard our previous episodes, please take a moment and say hello.
Well, hello. Yeah, I think the last time I talked with you was maybe about 5 years ago. I think Mike Wang was involved in that.
Yeah, we talked about your Ironmans, and then we also had you on for the Case I Can't Forget series about your patient the bump on the head.
That was
a good one.
Yeah, I'll never forget that, yeah. In fact, I'm going to talk to him next week. I want to make sure that he knows where I've gone. But
that's good follow-up.
Anyway, in that first discussion that we had, if I remember correctly, that at the end I said a couple of things that if you look back in retrospect predict what's going on now. I said I won't be chairman at Rush forever. That was something that was going through my mind. The first idea of it was coming through about then, because I'd been department chair for almost 15 years.
Yeah.
And you have to start and think, well, am I going to do this forever? Or am I going to do something else? I mean, what you have to be purposeful about what you want to do. Don't sleepwalk through your life. And the second thing I said was be mindful of time. And when you make time, make sure you're the one using the time, because there's no shortage of people who will use the time for you. So if you're sort of sleepwalking through life and, you know, your time may get sucked up by your family, your spouse, your boss, your institution, whatever, be purposeful about the time that you have and honor the person that you were when you were 20 when you first thought about this journey. And at the age of 20, I wanted to cure brain cancer, and I wanted to be very innovative. And in reality, I got to innovate on a few really, really cool projects in my career, but I became department chair so young. I was, I believe, the youngest department chair in the country in 2005. And it was not purposeful. I essentially stepped in a crisis. The dean had fired the prior chair and asked me to stabilize the department. I said, sure, I'll stabilize and then I'll do something else. Well, that was 18 years ago.
Yeah.
So I find myself having done something for 18 years that I didn't set out to do. I'm really pleased and honored that I did it. But being purposeful and honoring who I was when I was 20, I really wanted to do neurosurgical innovation. So I'm a math geek. I mean, I was on the soccer team and the wrestling team in high school, but I was also on the math team. And we won state in wrestling, but not because of me, but we did well at the state tournament in math because of me. I'm a math person. I love math. I read math books for fun to this day. And the innovation that I'm particularly interested in now is artificial intelligence in healthcare, particularly in neurosurgery. And AI at its soul is nothing but advanced math. That's really all it is.
Right.
It's Boolean algebra and Bayesian inference and linear algebra, all sorts of things that I love reading about, and that's what artificial intelligence is. So as I saw the AI revolution coming about, I decided that I would get in on it. I saw applications in neurosurgery. I wrote a patent in 2018 that I met with Google's DeepMind team about. I was very excited about it, but it was very clear that I couldn't get it done at my institution that really didn't want to share data. So I was going to have to do it somewhere else if I was going to do it. Well, a year later, Mayo Clinic signs a 10-year contract with Google to develop AI applications in healthcare. So about 2019, when I saw that, I thought, if I'm going to get this done, it's going to be at a place like that that wants to do it.
Yeah.
So that got my mind thinking about, if I were to take a step back into the innovations arena, that's where I might do it. So I'll also point out, I recently shared an article with you by an oncologist named Joseph Simone, who was a famous oncologist, ran the Huntsman Institute at Utah, was at Memorial Sloan Kettering, very well-known oncologist. But he wrote a paper, published a paper in 1999 called Simone's Maxims. I think that this should be mandatory reading for anybody in academic neurosurgery and every resident, so that they understand how academic medical centers work. And if you read that paper, and you know, you've known me for 5 or 6 years now, you read that paper and you see how staying longer as a department chair, longer than say 10 years, you know, most of what you can accomplish as a department chair, you'll get done in your first 10 years.
Yeah.
And then after that, it's just very, very difficult to get that last 10% of what you want done to get done. So at some point you have to just say, okay, I might not ever get that 10% that I want it done, but maybe the next person can. Maybe they'll figure out a way that I couldn't figure out. Maybe they'll have an innovation and some other idea that I didn't have. And maybe they'll be in a position with the institution to negotiate the resources to get that 10% done that you just couldn't.
Yeah.
So I saw within Simone's Maxim several things that I could very much identify with. And there's also points in there about when is it time to move on in leadership? And I recognized in several points my own circumstance. And it's hard to leave a place that you've been for a long, long time. I did my last cases at Rush last week. It was emotional, difficult to not work with that OR team again.
Right.
I love those people. You know, we started this department with 19 people in 2005. It was a residency program that was on probation at the time. And now there's 83 people. We started with one professor. Now there are, as of this year, there will be 9 full professors in the department. So we've accomplished so much. And I'm very, very proud to have been just a part of it. But at some point, if you feel like maybe it's time for someone else to pick up and run with this, and maybe it's time for me to go off and do something else, it takes a lot of courage to take that step. And, you know, in the end, my entire career, my life has been, you know, taking measured risks. And certainly this is a measured risk, but it's one that I'm betting on will lead me to hopefully some innovations that I think will be useful for neurosurgery in general.
Yeah, I mean, You talk about time, managing your time and controlling it as much as we can. And I remember our first conversation 5 years ago as well. I suppose our true first conversation was here in this room when I interviewed for a job with you. That was the day we met. But that first interview in San Francisco, the CNS meeting, where for anyone who actually listens and enjoys this podcast, I will tell you, I always say that this whole podcast was Dr. Wang's idea. But at that meeting, we tracked down Dr. Byrne in the hallway of the conference and asked him permission to let me do it because I had already matched here for residency and I was his new intern. And Dr. Wang said, you know, Dr. Byrne, we have this idea. Would we like to do it? Is it okay with you? And so we could give some credit to Dr. Byrne as well for allowing all of this to unfold. But thinking about time and the time you've spent here, not just as a young attending, then chairman thrust into it, and everything that you've built, a real murderer's row of neurosurgery, many of whom have also been on the show for our listeners. But I would like to ask you, and I think people would be interested, because you're known nationally, internationally as the chair here, all of your role in organized neurosurgery, epilepsy surgery, glioma surgery, but I wonder what Richard Byrne was like before all of that. If we could look back to your residency here at Rush, what were you like as a resident, in your own words, to be fair, but what was Rush like when you came to it before you had such a role in shaping it into the department we are today?
Well, I'll start with the department. It was a smaller department, but virtually every department in America was smaller.
Yeah.
I mean, the average residency program, you know, in 91 was one or one and a half residents. Private practice was a much bigger deal in neurosurgery back then than it was, than it is now. In fact, you cannot find a solo private practitioner in Cook County anymore. Mm. Everybody's been hired up by an academic system or a healthcare system. So all programs were smaller then. It was a very mature department. When I was hired as an attending, I was the youngest attending by 17 years. So I was really the kid. And as the kid, you know, all emergency cases came to me. Every clinical trial that everyone else didn't want to do became my clinical trial. Yeah. I mean, you just, that was the way it was. I mean, as a resident, I suppose I just tried to be a good soldier. Every other night call is not as much fun as it sounds. And then your last 2 years as a senior resident, it's every night call.
Yeah.
Because there isn't another senior resident to switch off with. So, and then covering Rush and Cook County was very, very difficult. County was extremely busy at the time. So when I look back, I just wanted to be a good soldier and survive the experience. And then I looked forward to what am I going to do next. And I did very well on the written boards, which is when Dr. Whistler finally paid attention to me. And I asked about doing a fellowship somewhere else. I wanted to do epilepsy surgery, awake glioma mapping. That's the stuff I was interested in. I'm still interested in. And he essentially just said, you're already overtrained in that. How about I'll send you to work with a couple of my friends, you know, Andre Olivier and George Ogeman, and then you come back and take over my practice, which was a dream in reality, and that's how it worked out. And then Charlie D'Angelo retired, and I did most of the skull-based surgery too. And so I suppose I was just wanting to be a good soldier, right? And I think that's the right mindset. When you're a resident, when you're a junior faculty member, because you know, your department needs you to take care of really sick people, and that's really what we do.
Yeah, I think that mindset and that culture lives on in the residency. It is interesting though, because being a good soldier so frequently means you're devoting yourself to the patients we're all caring for, but you're also devoting yourself to the department, to the family, to the residency for junior residents, right? And one of Simone's maxims that I've heard you quote several times over the past few years is that institutions don't love you back. And so you can devote yourself to the family of your residency, but devoting yourself to the larger institution may not always have the same bi-directional relationship, perhaps.
Yeah, I mean, institutions are brick and mortar.
Yeah.
They're buildings, they have a certain history to them, but in reality, it's all the people. Right? I mean, my loyalty is always going to be to people, not to a place. You know, again, our department, I love our department. We've got phenomenal people here. I'm just pleased to have been a part of it. The institution, I can show you the leadership has turned over so many times in my experience that there's administrators here, I've just never met them, right? And there are certain people that I'm very loyal to, like Omar Lateef, our CEO. I love Omar. Love Omar. He and his wife are over at my house for dinner Friday night.
Yeah.
There's certain people that I'll always be loyal to. But institutions, you know, the second maxim that Simone was talking about was an institution's timeline is infinite.
Right.
And yours is short. And the older you get, the shorter your timeline is, right? So I figure I've got another 10 to 15 years left in my career. Okay, it's time to take stock and say, now what? Now what? The easy, safe path is to do what I'm doing. I could have stayed on as department chair here forever. That wouldn't be good for me, wouldn't be good for the department. The right thing for me to do is to think, well, what do I want to get done? Be purposeful about your use of time. What do I really want to get done the next 10 to 15 years? I have national neurosurgery responsibilities that are very meaningful to me. But I really wanted, and I very much want, to be involved in the artificial intelligence revolution. If you haven't seen what's going on with the neurosurgical atlas, you're about to.
Yeah.
I was on a call with Aaron a couple of days ago, giving a testimonial about it. I've gotten a sneak peek. It's just amazing.
Atlas GPT, right?
Yes. It's really amazing.
Yeah.
And that's really fun to be a part of. Working with the dream team of people that Mayo Clinic has put together in AI is going to be fun for me too. And that's, in my opinion, that's purposefully navigating your career rather than just sleepwalking and say, well, I'm going back to the same desk every day forever. That's not purposeful, in my opinion. And it was certainly the easier path, but not the one that I chose.
Yeah. You know, I planned to do this whole interview just about your time at Rush, how you came to be the chair, what you did in your time, and then where you're going. But then you sent me this article, which I'll fully admit, I had never heard of Simone's Maxims. I had never read the paper. After reading it last night, I sent it to the entire residency here, and a few of the older guys were like, yeah, it's a classic, of course. Like, yeah, you haven't read that, you idiot?
Yeah.
And sure, but because you had me read this, there was one section, so much of what he lays out perfectly reflects my lived experience of your leadership here. Certainly, he has a section on leadership, a section on recruiting, a section on institutions, but there was one point where he laid out this timeline of academic eras. And I just want to get your thoughts, because he wrote this paper in 99, and so when he wrote it in the present day. And so he laid out the era of Osler, which was 1900 to 1945. It was all about diagnosis. There were few academic positions. Then in 1945, the NIH comes to be, and there's this rapid growth of academic positions because they're funding things. Then from 1965 to 1990, he said it's the Medicare, Medicaid era, where institutions are shifting to these new sources of revenue, and there's increased numbers of high-pay specialists like surgeons because there's revenue for them. And then his final era was from 1980 to his present, which was the for-profit era, where now there's managed care structures, there's biotech, there's more grants, and there's institutional support from industry. So with that quick overview of his timeline, I wonder, because you and I, many times in your operating rooms, we talk about Led Zeppelin, we talk about the Moody Blues, but we also talk about what's happening to modern healthcare systems. And we get to rant a little bit together in the corner. And so I know that you have opinions and you're an observer of the healthcare system writ large, not just in Chicago and here at Rush, but in our nation. So how would you describe our current era, I guess, within academic medicine or organized medicine overall, and where do you think it's all going as an extension of that timeline he laid out?
Yeah, so 99 was an interesting time. I was a young attending. We'd gone through the era of HMOs and PPOs,
yeah.
and then you know, money was plentiful in 99. There wasn't much pressure from CMS, and then money became more scarce, and it's only becoming more and more scarce. So I would say that we're entering a period of corporatization in medicine.
Mm.
I would say that the era of physician leadership, very, very important, is becoming more and more and more rare. I think that that is an undeniable trend. I also think that private practice is disappearing. I don't think it, I know it.
Yeah.
On the ABNS, I get to look at all the data. Where's everyone practicing? And the number of actual private practice doctors just really, really fallen off the table. So in the end, you end up working for somebody. And I think that's sort of sad, because the private practitioner gives us, it's like the free range animal, right? You can see how they actually live and how they do what they do. But that's not what most of our residents today take. Most of our residents go into either an academic model or they're hired by a healthcare system. And you end up working for somebody, and oftentimes that's not a doctor. So the mindset gets to be more, you're somebody who's sent to the work RVU mines to mine work RVUs.
Yeah.
That helps, and it, you know, somebody fill beds, which helps to fill everyone's paycheck. And you get separated from the process of actually fixing people. And that's a sad transition to me. Thankfully, I would say most doctors still keep themselves focused on the patients. You can't help it. I mean, when you see somebody suffering, how can you think about work RVUs? Who cares?
Right.
Who cares about what some administrator's target is? You're going to focus on the person. But I think that's a transition that's happening. I also think that things are being done with fewer and fewer resources and have to be done faster. I can tell you that in 1999, the private group that was here, on average, the neurosurgeons in that group did 131 cases. And that was enough for an adequate living.
Hmm.
Now our average person in this department does more than twice as many.
Yeah.
But they can't run two rooms. So it's become, you have to do twice as much, and it's harder to get twice as much done. So it's this sort of treadmill.
Yeah.
And the only way to slow down the treadmill is to just step off it. It's really hard to get the treadmill to stop otherwise. And I think it's, we're in an era of free agency, where if you're never willing to walk away from a contract, there's no bottom to which they'll take you in that contract.
Yeah.
And that's the advice I give to our residents when they finish. You know, I review contracts for residents, I look at it, and I say, oh, this all looks good, and now in 3 years, when they put you on a straight work RVU thing, you need to think about what next.
Mm.
You know, you have to be able to think of yourself as a free agent. And, you know, it's rare that somebody stays a third of a century in the same place the way I did. That's really rare these days. I think that's true across the country. So those are my thoughts. I do think, though, that value finds its value eventually. It has to search for it, though.
Mm.
If you are a really, really valuable person taking really good care of patients, you will be valued eventually, but you have to be willing to look for it.
Well, now I think it's time, Dr. Byrne, for me to indulge myself a little bit while I still have you.
Fire away.
So thinking about my time working with you here, before I get to the real fun part at the end of this conversation, I could frame it in three surgeries. When I was an intern, as I think you always do, and I've seen you do every year that I've been here, you called me down to do a burr hole for a chronic subdural with you, drilled the hole, told me to open the dura carefully, and of course I stuck the knife far too deep, blood sprayed all over my chest, and as one should, you laughed at me. And now every time I do a subdural, I open the dura so carefully. Even when it's completely unnecessary, I keep the subdural membrane, and I think in my head, there you go, Dr. Byrne. And whoever's standing next to me, I go, you know, one time with Dr. Byrne, and he made fun of me, and I preserve it with meticulous dissection of the dura, just so you know. When I was a PGY2, taking overnight call, you were on call with Joe Melinda, the chief at the time, and you came in at 2 in the morning to do a cauda equina. The only actual, out of thousands of consults, the only real cauda equina I've seen in my life. And we did it in the middle of the night, and we of course took an x-ray, but then you came in and took a cob and you went, that's the sacrum. And you showed me percussing the sacrum and localizing it by sound. And then just a few months ago, I did what I suppose now will be the last surgery I ever do with you, which was, of course, a shunt, which was very appropriate because out of every neurosurgeon I've met, adult, pediatric, spine, tumor, trauma, you name it, you are the most enthusiastic and positive about shunts of any neurosurgeon I've ever met in my life. It's a simple way that we help people.
Well, every time you do a shunt, you save someone's life.
Right.
Every time you do a chronic subdural, you save someone's life. And if you think back to why you went into this, you should be enthused about that.
I mean, right.
It's simple plumbing, but if you do it right and you respect the case, you're gonna save somebody's life. I mean, how much more wonderful is that? I mean, you get a half hour to save someone's life. That's incredible.
It's a real privilege. But now the true fun, which I think you went into our call room a couple of years ago and found this thing, but when I was a junior resident, I made a list of what we called burnisms, which were some...
You know, I wondered who put that together.
Yes. I mean, we all gathered them, but I'm the one that hung it on the wall like Martin Luther's thesis. But I just want to read a couple of them to
sure,
you.
Sure.
One, to actually ask you, you know, where did you hear that? Did you come up with it yourself? What does it mean to you? But also, just for our listeners, some of these are just funny, but some of them are, I would go so far as to say, wise, and things that I do repeat to myself sometimes when I'm operating or when I'm seeing patients. So for the funny ones, a little asystole doesn't bother me.
Yeah, so that what that comes from...
Is that a
from,
story?
No, it's... I've done a few hundred acoustics and a lot of CP angle tumors, and sometimes when there's any disturbance of the pons, the particularly the fifth cranial nerve, you'll get asystole.
Yeah.
And it's very, very scary for the anesthesiologist. For me, I just kind of shrug my shoulders and laugh a little bit. Helps out with hemostasis, but it'll always go away as long as you just stop disturbing the pons or the fifth cranial nerve. It's also true in trigeminal neuralgia surgery, percutaneous rhizotomies, and
yeah.
So on. And it's always entertaining for me to watch the anesthesiologist panic, but I know it'll come back.
Yeah. Here's a few that I'll give you as a group because they pertain to some of the more difficult things we find ourselves dealing with. Some days you're the bat, some days you're the ball. This person doesn't need a neurosurgeon, they need a priest. And then finally, which I think sums it up nicely, the operation you're doing should be less morbid than the disease you're treating.
Yeah. Yeah, I think sometimes we get carried away with excessive surgery. I would say that both cranial and spine surgeons can be guilty of that. And I think you just have to step back and just say, you know, make sure that the potential risks of what you're doing are lower than what you're trying to stop.
Yeah.
I mean, it's pretty straightforward stuff.
Some things that I frequently say in my head or to people with me in the operating room, hands at half speed, you're in the posterior fossa. Better to leave a little tumor on carotid than a little carotid on the tumor. Everything is adjustable. It's up to you to adjust it. You know, Dr. Fessler's a couple doors down, so I'll lower my voice, but sometimes minimally invasive can be minimally effective.
That's true.
And then finally, if we can't find this tumor, we should just hang it up. Those are fun. But then the one that I truly do say out loud, you can ask any resident junior to me in this program, any medical student who's on our service, whether it's a sub-I or just someone rotating through, and the one that I want to finish with, the case isn't over until you talk to the family.
Very true. Very true. Yeah, I mean, they're part of it. They're suffering. They're the caregivers. And, you know, I think that's particularly true in the more morbid cases that we do. You gotta let them know what's going on. Make sure that they know that you're there, you're taking care of it, and you'll see their loved one through.
Beautiful. Well, those burnisms I think stack up very nicely with Simone's maxims. It's been a real honor to work under you here for these 5 years. I look forward to seeing you again in Jacksonville, Florida, my hometown, where I'm very proud that you'll be finishing out your career. Thank you for this conversation and the ones before.
Well, I appreciate it. It's been an incredible honor to have worked with all of the 83 people in our department and all of the people here. If I were to retire today, I would retire very, very satisfied with what I've done. I've got one more story. I've got one more build with a department. I have one more innovation I want to get done, and I'm just trying to be purposeful about what I'm doing with that time.
And we'll talk about it once you do and see how it all goes.
I'll be back for graduation. So, yeah.
Great.
Looking forward to that.
Disclaimer time. The opinions and ideas expressed in this show are solely those of myself, Dr. Wang, and our guests. They do not represent the opinions of any professional institution or organization. This show is for entertainment purposes only and does not constitute the giving of medical or legal advice. Listening to or participating in this show does not constitute continuing medical education or any other professional certification. It's just a show, everybody.